This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jonah Joe, and you're listening to The Ideas Network. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri is back to talk about the history of insects. We'll also review the spring bugs you might see around your house and, of course, take your questions. Have you seen spongy moth nests around your yard yet? Are you concerned about ants invading your home this spring? What bug questions do you have for Phil? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Or you can always send an email, and that's ideas@wpr.org. Hi, Phil.
How are you?
Not too bad. Little hoarse today, but we're making it through. Thanks for being with us again.
Well, nice to be there. I one of these days it's going to warm up enough to see some of the insects moving around.
I know. It's been kind of a strange spring, hasn't it?
Yeah. You know, and one of the most common questions I get at this time of the year historically is, what had the winter, will it have much of an effect on insects? And honestly, unless you get incredibly extreme situations, which we have not had, I don't really give the winter a whole lot of factor. I tend to watch the spring weather more than anything. And the thing that gets insects in trouble is if it finally warms up enough and you wake them up and then you slam the door with some extreme weather, then things get unsettled. But they're pretty much still laying low for probably the next 3 or 4 weeks, I'm guessing.
Okay, well, don't expect to have a break in the bugs then. But we wanted to really talk to you right away about this kind of history about bugs and the insects that were on the earth millions of years ago. What can you tell us about them?
Well, you know, as a scientist, I'm really quite amazed at literally the size of some of the things that were, you know, before and during the dinosaurs. Because insects, their organ systems are not set up to be a large animal. You know, they just can't move their body fluids around and the like. And so, you know, I'm amazed at the big, you know, Hercules beetles and things we see now. And you find some of those things, you know, back millions of years ago were 3-4 times the size. And to me, it's almost like science fiction. But that also goes to the point that when you see the science fiction movie where the insects are as big as cars, that just never could happen. So.
Okay, well, it's good to know that. What were some of the early insects, and what did they look like?
Well, and we have relatives. I mean, cockroaches are always considered some of the more primitive things you see, earwigs, even grasshoppers. A lot of the insects have more of a simple type of development. So we definitely have relatives of those critters that are still in existence today. But insects are always constantly evolving, and so, of course, the ones that you see from millions of years ago may look somewhat similar, but they really are different species than what we're dealing with now.
Okay. What made those cockroaches so tough, by the way?
Just resilient. I mean, they adapt to a lot of different habitats. A lot of them are kind of scavengers, so, you know, they can eat a variety of diets. And it really is quite interesting, because if you see some of these things that are preserved in amber and whatnot that are millions of years old, they really, in many cases, look almost identical to what we find now.
Has that been very helpful in the study of, like, prehistoric insects, them getting covered with amber or
definitely
sap?
Although, you know, sometimes what happens is our best theories go down the tubes, because it turns out that they really didn't hold. But, yes, definitely gives us a lot, and you continually see people discovering new things. And, as I said, some insects have evolved immensely, other ones very little at all in that time frame.
So speaking about new discoveries, I believe that just last month they found some of the oldest known pollen carrying bugs. What can you tell us about those?
Yeah, those are some earwig relatives, and I think the big thing is between finding the pollen associated with them and knowing that association with plants. It's another one of these cases the discovery takes us, and we can move the insects back even farther in prehistoric times as far as when they were active and important in pollinating and the like. Now, these critters didn't fly like earwigs. You know, they have wings, but they're really pretty functionless in most cases. So they were crawling from plant to plant. But by doing that, they would pick up pollen. And, of course, the plants evolved to depend on that kind of service. So it's really quite interesting.
That's very interesting. So what are the causes of the insects going from
very large to the teeny tiny creatures that we have today?
Well, I mean, there was always small insects. Again, I think the problem with very large critters is that it is not an efficient system, and that puts them at a disadvantage. And so I think the trend would be more efficient to be a smaller insect, and that's the direction things have went.
Oh, that makes total sense. Thank you. Well, we've got a caller already, so let's go to Greg in Sheboygan. Hi, Greg.
Hello. When I was a child, I used to run at mud puddles just to chase the yellow sulfur butterflies. They would fly up in clouds. I used to collect butterflies. I could go out and get red admirals or painted ladies or woody satires or whatever I wanted to get. I could go out and just go after that butterfly and catch it. And now I haven't seen these butterflies in years and years. Mm-hmm. Butterflies and insects have been on the earth for 40 million years. And I think they're there before the Neogene. They are going extinct.
Okay.
They get viruses. We got the honeybee. We got the oral vaccine for the honeybee for Israeli paralytic virus, I believe it is.
Yeah, well, you know, some of it, it's interesting to watch. I think one of the things people in my age bracket often sit back and talk about how, boy, there seemed to be a lot more critters out there when we were young. When you'd go by a streetlight in the middle of summer and it was just a cloud of insects. You don't see that now. You know, one of the things that we've seen with butterflies is just as habitats have changed and in particular become more restricted, that pays more on the diversity you're going to see than anything else. If you go out in the country, because sulfur butterflies feed on alfalfa, you go out and it's not every summer, but in the right time in the summer, you can see the same kind of clouds you remember as a kid. But I totally agree with you. We don't see near the diversity in our gardens as we did before. But again, I live in a place right now, I grew up in Madison, and where I live now was farmland when I was a kid. And now the closest farm is at least 3 or 4 miles from me. And you know, that makes a big impact. And so if I have to go looking for something, you have to do a little bit of digging, you know, what kind of plants I like, where can I find those plants? And most of the time, you got to get out in diverse habitats, whether it's prairies or woodlands or the like. And if the plants that the insect caterpillars feed on are there, you got a pretty good chance of finding the critters. And that's what we don't see for the most part when we get into the city and larger urban areas.
Okay, thanks for the call. Yeah, you know, we've had a lot of people on the show and who have done lots of research on this problem, basically, of fewer insects. Are you familiar with any of those studies, Phil?
Yeah, you know, at times you get, with science, people have different views on this. Now, I think the disturbing thing is you see people that have been collecting insects and monitoring numbers and whatnot for decades can show incredible declines, and it's worldwide.
Yes.
You know, that's the thing that gets your attention, whether it's Germany or Puerto Rico or whatnot. Now, other times you see figures thrown out. I know I read a recent paper where they were talking about the decline might be quite as much as we expect, but what they were referencing is bugs smashed on the side of cars. You know, and indeed, yes, there are less insects out there, but also some of that has to do with the design of cars and whatnot. So it's more complicated than just giving you a single figure that everybody would be comfortable with saying is what the decline is. But it's definitely a decline. And of course, if the insects decline, the birds decline. I mean, there's just a whole litany of concerns there. And although we think we understand some of this, we definitely don't have a handle on all the things that are going on there, other than, again, the sheer biomass of insects out there continues to decline. And then the other thing that gets things really kind of mixed up is, you know, if we talk about all the insects that we have, even in the state of Wisconsin, that are not native here, that are, you know, relatively recent, the last 200 to 300 years, and how that changes the landscape. And in some cases, they push out some of our native species and cause them to decline. And the other thing that I could guarantee running the lab, and PJ has his same experience now, is that every year we see a handful of things in the state we have never seen before. Thank goodness most of them don't get to be a problem, but at times they do, and it kind of changes the landscape.
for sure. It's a very important question. I'm glad that there are a lot of people doing research on it. If you've got a question for Phil or a comment, give us a call, 800-642-1234. All the lines are open. And, of course, you can send an email. That's ideas@WPR.org. And we do have an email from Anne in Franklin. She says for approximately 1 month, she's had an outbreak of box elder bugs inside her home. Almost every day, she'll find between 2 and 6 bugs. Are they newly hatched, or could they have wintered over somewhere and now emerging? She's managing them by removing them as she finds them, and she's lived in the home for 30 years and never had this happen. Well, Anne, just let you know, an outbreak is not a few bugs. I've had an outbreak. We're talking hundreds.
So box elder bugs are a native insect that tends to breed on box elder and in some cases maple, especially silver maple. In their claim to fame, they really cause very little damage other than the seeds of those plants. But in the fall of the year, they hibernate as adults in structures and under bark of trees and the like. And then once they get access to walls and attics, if things warm up, you can see them in January and the like. But now as we're getting to the point that your walls are warmer than they were in January, and insects being cold-blooded, they react to that. So they're starting to be active. So I can guarantee not breeding in the house. Everything is a result of what happened last September and October. In general, their populations are the highest during dry falls because there is a fungus disease that is normally a natural control for them. And if things are wet, they get moldy and die before they get to that point. The one question, so, you know, box elder trees have probably always been in our neighborhood. If things change like that, I start worrying about something that structurally has changed in the house. Have some screens come off vents? Or other things that happen that allow the insects more access to her walls and attic space than in the past. You know, if somebody said, I've only been in the house in 3 years, that's not enough time to get a picture of the kind of things that can happen. But for somebody that's been in the house a long time and to see that kind of dramatic change, that's the direction I'd look at. Did they have some construction, something else that all of a sudden the insects, when their numbers are high, they're having an easy time getting in the walls, and then you pay for it. Good choice on her part of just taking them outside. Spraying is not very effective at this time of year because you can't spray where they're coming from. So what we tend to preach is trying to first, if you solve the riddle how they get in and get that sealed, they don't get in and they're not a problem. There are some soapy water solutions and other things that you can spray on the outside of, let's say, an old farmhouse that is just so leaky there's no way you can seal it up enough. But that has to be done in September before they get in. And as I said, this time it's not worth doing much. Sometimes you can solve the riddle. You know, they're always show up in the living room. I would look at the light fixture coming out of the ceiling to make sure they're not squeezing through there. So rarely is it that easy, but those are the kind of things you got to think about is how's the little stinkers finding access into my living space.
And if for those of us who have had big infestations, what is the best way to take care of them? I've always been told a vacuum cleaner, and that seems to work.
Yeah, pretty good. Not so much with box elder bugs. Asian lady beetles have a little bit of a problem that when they're disturbed, they bleed through their joints and they can stain things.
Yeah.
So you got to be a little careful with that. And if there is some spots left behind, I'd get after them pretty quick because they're protein-based, and protein has a habit of causing some stain problems if you let it sit for time. But, yeah, vacuum cleaner works good. If somebody really had to get after things, there is an insecticidal soap, and it doesn't work against thick body things like beetles. And so there's a critter called an elm leaf beetle that, on occasion, not near as common as box elderbug, is just one of these fall, winter nuisance problems. It's thick-skinned enough, I don't trust the soap. But things like box elder bugs and the like, it works pretty good.
Okay, great. Thank you for that call or for that email, and good luck with that, Anne. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Clara Neipert is our on-air producer and regular producer today, and Trina LaSouza is our technical director. And we're talking with Phil Pelletieri. He's an entomologist and Distinguished Faculty Associate Emeritus at UW-Madison. And he's back with us to answer your questions or comments. And we've got one line open, so 800-642-1234. And, of course, you can always send an email. That address is ideas@WPR.org. So, Phil, let's go right back to the phones. Chris in La Crosse has a comment. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I have two questions. One, and you explained a little bit about the Asian beetles. I have a terrible time with the Asian beetles, and I had heard that clove oil seems to help, and I did put cloves around, and I think it did help. And I know where they're coming from. I mean, there's cracks, and, you know, it's a 30-year-old house. There are cracks that we can't close up. But is there anything I can do about that? And then my second question is about flies. I have a cabin where we had a tornado, and ever since that tornado happened, I have to get some of the house fixed, and we have flies coming in everywhere.
True.
So I have a question about that, too.
So honestly, they're somewhat related. The fly that's bothering you is called a cluster fly, and it looks like a house fly, but honestly, it's an earthworm parasite. That's it, how it reproduces by its maggots killing earthworms. But in the fall of the year, it invades. And I think what's going on with the cabin is it tends to hit sunny south sides of structures. And I'm suspicious before the tornado, you had enough trees around that the cabin stayed shady and they couldn't find it. But once sun hits it, it's almost like a magnet. And again, in the end of August and especially September, they start to gravitate in. And just like the Asian lady beetles, they're good at squeezing in, you know, through soffits and vents and all those kind of places. And then when things warm up, you go to the cabin, you know, light a fire, warm the walls up. All of a sudden, there's flies everywhere. And so it's kind of the same strategy. As I said, what you like about if you can solve it with, you know, caulk and steel wool and other things is that if you solve the riddle, it's done. You don't have to intervene every year, whereas if you rely on some kind of treatments outside, and I can see the clove oils might have some repellency, but it's relatively short distance, you know. So if an Asian lady beetle is, I'm sure, you know, a couple inches away, it wouldn't surprise me it would be repelled. But that doesn't stop them from getting in your walls and the like. And so it takes some detective work, but you literally look around all your window frames to make sure that those are caulked and sealed well. The other weakness, even if it looks like it's structurally sound, I think in most cases are our overhangs. Because, you know, in my case, they have a piece of plastic that's laying on and there's a little aluminum ridge. And every 3 inches, I've got a little seam that things can crawl up underneath. Now, I'm blessed in that where I'm in the middle of the city, I don't get, you know, I get a couple stink bugs and whatnot in the house, but not the kind of numbers that become bothersome. And if you're going to err on the house, where you should start is on the south side in particular, because, again, so many of these insects rely on sun and heat, and so that seems to attract them. It's much more unusual to have a structural problem on the north side of the house. It just, you know, isn't conducive for insects coming in. But and as I said, I'm just suspicious. Did it happen in the cabin? Did you lose quite a few trees up there?
Yes, we lost a lot of trees. And also, I have to have the soffits and everything redone, which is going to happen this spring. And so I was wondering if there are things that, you know, we can watch for when we redo the siding and the soffits and
sure.
things.
There's a case where, you know, house wraps and other types of devices that both, you know, help you energy-wise but also put a physical seal up would be worth a while. So they said just kind of you put your mindset in small cracks and things and openings and seeing what kind of adjustment. Could be screening. It could be something like this, you know, Tyvek or other names for some of these house wraps you could set up. And you know, it's good that you got to get after that stuff now, because that's exactly the direction I think I'd send you as far as putting your effort into trying to keep the insects out.
Okay, thank you so much, Chris, and good luck with getting that cabin back in shape. Let's go next to Kathy in Arcadia. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I have a question concerning Japanese beetles. When they first started in the state of Wisconsin, or when we saw them, because I'm on the western side of the state, and I think they've come from the east. But I've certainly had a lot of difficulty with them in the past 4 years. And I should say that I live in the country. I have numerous crab apples. I have an orchard with apples and pears and plums and apricots. So I have just a bountiful place for these beetles now that they are there. And I don't know if they will ever leave me. So that's my question.
Well, I hope your experience is mine. It's similar to mine. Now, you know, we have records of Japanese beetles back in the 50s, but they kind of died out on their own. And things started rumbling in the 90s. And I honestly remember because in my lab, there were some intercepts at nurseries and the Department of Ag got involved. But things really got crazy around year 2000. And at that point, there wasn't a birch tree in my neighborhood that had a leaf on it by August. Rose bushes, grapes. I mean, it's just they have such a wide variety of plants they feed on. And what is frustrating is that they come in from a mile or two down the road. It's not like they are breeding on your property and causing the problems in most cases. And they're flying for 2 months. So they eat a whole bunch of things. They're coming from a place you can't stop them, and they're bothering you for a long period of time. So it really is one of the most frustrating insects to deal with. That being said, I live about two blocks from a golf course, and some of my colleagues that were working with Japanese beetle could find densities as high as 60 per square foot of the grubs in the golf courses, which is just mind-boggling. And in those kind of numbers, they can damage the golf course. Fast forward 20 years. Last year, if I could have found more than 20 Japanese beetles all summer long, either in my yard or walking around, that might have been the peak. I mean, it just, the numbers dropped off, but it took time. So from the time that they got ridiculous to the time it started getting at least to the point of being, well, just, you know, kind of a minor pest, was about 12 to 15 years. And so I'm hoping that's the direction, and it definitely did move. I mean, my first heavy populations that I recall were down in Janesville, which is pretty much, you know, southern part of the state, and then they evolved from there. And I'm sure there are some areas of the state they still are just moving into. What seems to be the big thing is that the grubs in particular start to pick up some disease problems, and that's probably what's controlling them more than anything else. But it's somewhat relative in the sense that, you know, when you got apples going and they're feeding on a small apple, just a couple little bites out of an apple by one beetle pretty much ruins the apple. You know, so it is somewhat relative as far as how much damage you can experience. So, you know, you run a couple directions you can try to fight the battle. One that will not work for you is you start planting things that they don't like. There are some plants that they just don't mess, but fruit trees and whatnot are kind of high on the list. If things don't get better, there are sprays. They do respond to sprays. There's even some organic sprays. What's frustrating about the sprays is they'll last for 10 days, sometimes not even that long, and then so you have to reapply it because they're flying for 2 months a number of times, and so it becomes a high maintenance. Raspberries in particular, just they can be devastating on raspberries and are quite frustrating. Now, with raspberries, sometimes people can build netting cages and whatnot to somewhat physically protect them. One thing I would suggest is not worth your effort is there are some interesting, and again, organic even, treatments that you can put on lawns and grass to kill the grubs. And they're great if that's what your problem is. But with all the history of problems that I had in my yard, as far as them eating our ornamental plants and vegetables, I never had enough grubs in my lawn to make it worthy to treat them. It wouldn't have made any difference, as I said, as it did, because I considered my main source in the golf course. Why they thrive in the golf course is because it's always perfect out there. You know, they're irrigating it and the like. Whereas, you know, most our lawns, I think when we go through those dry spells, especially in the late summer, that's pretty tough on the grubs. And that helps keep their numbers down aside from those natural controls. So the one question, how long basically have they been a frustrating problem for you?
Really, for the past 4 years, and as you say, I've gone from, you know, previously having nice apples to now I have to really pick through my apples, my raspberries. I've kind of given up on my raspberries because they just have ruined them, and it's made my whole orchard area so difficult. They can be, you know, you can go out there when they're out, when there's lots of them, and the trees, you can just see them crawling on the trees, and it's just sad. It's just made sad.
One thing to consider, and for most people, I don't send them this direction because it can cause more problems than it solves. I'm not a big fan of Japanese beetle traps, but the reason that I'm not a fan is if I put one in my yard, I know I will draw more beetles into my yard and I don't catch them all, so it makes it worse. But if you've got a big enough property, the argument could be that you could put them far enough away from the plants that they're attacking that they will go to the traps. And the traps are just a baffle trap that has an attractant, and the beetles come in and fall into a container and or garbage bag, and that's how they're caught. So that might help draw them away. The other thing is sometimes if you win the war early, and I tell this story from my own experience. We had some potentillas in the front of the house. I never saw a yellow flower on them when they were real bad because the Japanese beetles would eat the flowers right off. I normally shy away from treating, especially something like that, which is cosmetic. It's not going to kill the plant. But I was treating something else in the garden that had to be treated. I had a little bit of spray, so I sprayed the potentillas. This is about the first week of July when things are really starting to rock and roll. I never saw beetles there again. Unfortunately, they decided I'll go over my neighbor's cotone aster hedge and got after that. And
oh, dear.
What happens is the beetles literally gang up. The physical feeding on the leaves and whatnot gives off chemicals that attract more beetles, and also the females attract the males. And so the argument is if you can persuade them another direction early, it often takes quite a bit of the pressure off. And so that's something else to keep in mind. But as I said, I would at least toy, because the beetle traps aren't that expensive. If you've got a big enough area that you could keep them, let's say, 200 yards away from your orchard, it might be worth setting up a trap or two and just see if that lessens the problem somewhat. Because, as I said, you're kind of drawing away in that case, whereas most of us can't do that in our own yards because our yards aren't big enough. In fact, the old joke used to be you buy the Japanese beetle traps for your neighbor. But, you know, of course, that would not be nice to your neighbor. But as I said, the traps, they're feel good. There's not a pesticide involved with them. It's a physical way of reducing the numbers. But as I said, if when you understand how they work, you can see where they can be more of a problem than a solution in most cases.
Okay. Well, thank you for the call, Kathy. Hopefully they'll be going down for you. Let's take an email. Tom emailed and wanted to know what the latest is on bed bugs and the control of them. And do bed bugs hibernate? He'd also like to know if there are any books, websites, or whatever to find out how to control them or prevent them from coming.
Oh, there's just been an explosion in the last 20 years because bed bugs was a non-issue to speak of early in my career, and then we saw this explosion, which a lot of it had to do with a resistance built up to the normal indoor pesticides, among other things, and some of it had to do with behaviorally, because we didn't have bed bugs, we do things. I mean, used furniture, old mattresses and whatnot are quite scary because of the potential of physically bringing them in. Hibernating, their activity is purely temperature dependent, but what is amazing about them is if I, let's say, had an infested couch and I decided, oh, I'm going to get even with them, I'm going to put the couch out in my garage all winter long, they would survive that.
Oh.
What it is that as the temperature is cool, they basically go into a hibernation-like state, and they can stay that way. Now, what's interesting, if I take that same bed bug and it's 70 degrees and I put it in my in a pillow and I put it in the freezer overnight, I'm probably going to kill it. But it's the shock, the big drastic temperature change, and that's what doesn't happen with items that you think that, our winter would be cold enough. They gradually get cooler. The bed bugs adapt to that.
Mm.
So, again, one of the frustrations was that the normal sprays were marginal at best in controlling them. So a couple things have happened. There have been a couple other products, but the development of new pesticides has really been slowed in going a different direction. If there's agricultural markets, making organic things and all kinds of stuff is worth it. But for something as innocent as a bed bug, it just isn't a big market, so it's not a priority for the people developing. That being said, understanding their biology, one of the biggest directions to go to deal with a bed bug problem is to cook them out, to heat them out. And so in a lot of cases, they will come in with machines and generate about 140 degrees air temperature. They got to be a little careful there because, some things are sensitive to that temperature. But basically, you can heat them up. And if you can get the bed bug above about 110, 112 degrees, it's dead. It will not survive. And, of course, the frustration with that treatment is that it's expensive. I mean, they have to bring machines in. You know, a couple people have to set them up. They have to monitor it and whatnot. So it is not an inexpensive way. And where things get very difficult is if you have an eight-unit apartment and you have a suspicion that they're all infested or at least part of it. And for the most part, you've got to treat at least the adjacent areas to being infested. You're talking quite a bit of money, and people don't have those kind of resources. So, you know, there are some physical reasons why they have been frustrating. But it is a solvable problem. And the other thing that has changed, I think, is, you know, people used to pick these up a bit as they travel. You know, bed bugs are good at hitchhiking on things. So you put your suitcase down next to an infested bed, there's a chance that they could crawl in, and then you bring the suitcase home, and all of a sudden you've got bed bugs. So that was one scenario. But in particular, the hotel industry and whatnot, because they have been devastated in some cases by some of these problems, have taught their people what to look for. And so we're catching the bed bug problems before they get near as crazy as they used to. And so that's helped a lot. So to be honest, when I'm traveling, I remove the sheet back and I look for little black spots, which are their waste spots on the mattress seam. I also look on picture frames. They love wood for some reason. They'll go underneath the picture frames. And so look for signs of bed bugs. If I don't see that, I feel pretty comfortable, although I will tell you that I take my suitcase and we store it in the bathtub.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that.
Yeah, you know, so there are some physical adjustment things you can do. There are ways. It's interesting. I have a relative down in Florida that it got so bad they had to have their house fumigated. I was disappointed they didn't call me because I didn't think it needed to go that far. But I understand why they got frustrated. You couldn't have that done up here. We don't have the equipment or the people that have the training to do those kind of fumigations, but it shows you how desperate people can get to solve the problem. We talked about heating. They had some physical problems in the house why they couldn't heat it the way it should be heated, so they couldn't go that direction. But in general, I think it's less of an issue than it was about the time I retired, when it was just about kind of at the peak of it. But it's still there, and you do still hear those horror stories. And again, so I'm real cautious and tell people to be cautious about, you know, used furniture, those kind of things. Not that you can't get used furniture, but at least inspect it, like, because I think physically that is the argument, that most of the time you're bringing them in on items. There's all these other urban legends that don't hold true. Somebody is telling me they thought they were coming in from boxes of things that are shipped to your house from warehouses. And you just don't find bed bugs in warehouses. They have to be around where people are all the time. Mm-hmm. And the like. And so, as I said, you got to be a little careful there, that sometimes people just don't quite understand the dynamic here and are pointing fingers in directions that aren't worth the effort.
Well, thanks for clearing that up for us, and thanks for the email, Tom. Much appreciated. Let's go back to the phones, and Jamie in Algoma has a question.
Hey, I was wondering what you could tell me about zombie spiders. We had toured an older house and noticed these really creepy white, some of them barely moving, some of them not, spiders hanging from the ceiling in the basement. I understand it's caused from a fungus, I think. And
I was confused, and I was wondering what would cause... there are a lot more fungal diseases of various insects and the like than I think people are aware of. They are a very common natural control. They need more humid situations. That's the way funguses work. And so, again, because basements are often a little bit damper than the rest of the house, plus there's critters running around, so there's reasons why spiders find that to be a better habitat. But sure enough... If the fungal spore gets and germinates, it literally causes a fungal infestation, and the insect will die from that. And then you have this little critter sitting there. And when funguses mature, you often see the fuzz on the outside. In fact, if you look under the microscope, you'll often see spores on the outside. And this is how the fungus disseminates. It puts these tiny spores out in the environment that blow around. And again, if one of those lands on a spider and the conditions are right, then it will perpetuate itself and control it. And, you know, the skin of all arthropods is so plastic-like that, you know, under the right conditions, the stuff just does not degrade. Now, the fungus, honestly, will increase the speed of the degradation because it's literally tearing it down. But, you know, it wouldn't surprise me to see the carcass of a dead spider even a year or two after it happened. And one can argue, again, it's just a natural control. And I'm not aware of any of the fungi that are associated with insects that are issues with people. So, you know, you don't have to worry about that aspect of it.
Phil Trina, our board op here, looked up a picture of these so-called zombie spiders, and they're white and very scary looking.
Yeah, well, you know, their body proportions will change because of the fungus a little bit and the like. And, yeah, I mean, fungal problems in insects are really quite interesting and interesting. Thing that in some cultures, moldy insects, if you want to use that term, are literally have some medicinal properties and the like. In fact, there's even a type of fungus that's associated with insects that was considered a performance-enhancing drug, believe it or not, and used in athletic situations.
Oh, my gosh.
The chemistry of this stuff is just wild. It's definitely not an area of my expertise, but it was always fascinating. To see, and again, as you read about discoveries in the fungal world of some of these interesting and in some cases useful properties that some of these fungi have and some of the chemicals that they have.
So much to learn about the insect world for sure. Jamie, thank you so much for calling. Back with us today is Phil Pelletieri. He's an entomologist and a Distinguished Faculty Associate Emeritus at UW-Madison. What bug questions do you have? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Coming up tomorrow, we have tax expert Mary Mellum back to help you with your last-minute tax questions. And right now, we're talking about insects, and we've got a lot of calls waiting. And Mark and Lynn will get to you right away because you've been waiting for a long time. Mark first. Mark in Sussex, what's your question?
Thanks for taking my call. I found what Mr. Pelletieri said about the Japanese beetles to be very accurate because I saw my potentillas for the first time last year, and it's been quite a while. My question was about ticks, though. Have those tiny little lime ticks pushed out or had any effect on the old big wood ticks? I don't know their exact names. Have they?
Sure. The lime ticks we refer to as the deer tick, although it's technically the black-legged tick. And in relative terms, it is recent in the state. The first one was discovered in the 60s. It was more of a southern tick, and the one key factor that allowed its populations to expand out of the northwest part of the state. It was up by Spooner was the first areas they were found, is deer densities. As the deer populations went up, that was good for them. They don't displace the native, what we call a wood tick, although technically, entomologists call it the American dog tick. They kind of feed on the same things, although I will tell you that the old-fashioned wood tick we find in much broader habitats. I mean, I can find wood ticks occasionally in my backyard, and they're hitchhiking on squirrels and the like. I do not find deer ticks or black-legged ticks in my backyard. But if I go out west of Madison and hike in Governor Dodge State Park or the like, that is great habitat, and so I find them. The main thing that we wanted people to understand about ticks, the wood tick is kind of a spring and early summer thing, and then they're pretty much done. The argument about the black-legged or deer tick is there is a life stage out every time it's above about 35 degrees, and there's no snow on the ground. And so they're there all summer long. In fact, I have seen and picked up ticks in January when you get a January thaw and there's some bare ground and you get on the south side of a hill and it's 40 degrees and sunny. Be darned, you can pick up ticks then. And so we have to keep our guard up much longer. And, of course, the other big problem is that there's four diseases associated with it that are transmitted to humans, whereas with the wood tick, Although technically they can spread Rocky Mountain spotted fever, that is a very, very rare occurrence in Wisconsin. And so they're much less of a concern as far as making people sick. But, you know, the whole state, we had records of them in every county by 1990s. They still seem to be more prevalent for the most part on the western edge of the state than they are on the eastern side. And so, again, if you're a person who spends a lot of time outdoors and you start to experience running in these ticks in the places you hang out, it's best, you know, to either, you know, clothe yourself, but in particular consider putting tick sprays on your clothing so that the ticks don't have an opportunity to get on your person.
Okay, thanks for the call, Mark. And Lynn in Stevens Point, thank you for waiting.
Hello. I am calling because I have a problem with gnats in my house, little tiny ones. I guess they could even be called no-see-ums. I am a potter, and they seem to love the clay and the glaze and me while I'm working on it. They hang around my house plants. I do have those sticky things in the plants so that it catches them. But, you know, they bother us sometimes when we're eating and stuff like that, too.
So, you know, I think they're just coming onto the clay because of the habitat that's around. Plus, as you know, they get everywhere. But it all goes back to your house plants. I'm guessing they're fungus gnats. That's the most common little gnat we get in the house. And fungus gnats breed on the organic matter in the soil. And it's interesting. I mean, there are potting mixes that don't have organic matter, and so they wouldn't do well in that. But if you've got garden soils or other things, even with leaf mulch, that's where the critters breed, and then they pretty much bother you from then. So I assume that you've got at least a few potted houseplants around?
Yes. So that they're the critter. I mean, they're the culprits then.
Right. So there is, you know, whether you mail order it or to go a larger nursery, there is a bacterial insecticide that's made for killing the maggots of those gnats. And again, knowing that it's fungus gnats, you find something that is registered for treating fungus gnats in houseplant soil and put it on, and it should shut the populations down. You might have to reapply it. It depends how bad it is. But, you know, that's getting at the source of it. The adult critters are really not much of an issue, and if you're not going to be able to catch them all anyway, you're basically, to head them off at the pass, you've got to stop the breeding. And as I said, and there are occasions that we find them on other things, although these are more rare. Again, it's organic matter. So honestly, you know, in the fall of the year, if somebody had a pumpkin in the basement and started to get a little bit spongy and the like, they could breed on something like that. There are other little gnats that we find, again, in decaying potatoes and those kind of things. But from your description and from the continued reoccurrence, as I said, I think it's just the typical fungus gnats that we get in houseplants. And the adults don't always – it's like fruit flies. They don't always tell you where the problem is. You got to think of what's the breeding site and take care of that.
Okay. Thank you, Lynn. What a horrible problem when you're making a pot. Although it could be texture. So, you could look at it like that. Thanks, Lynn. Let's go back. We've got Chris in Black Creek. Hi, Chris.
Hey, guys. A great show again, as always. So the spiders in the basement, you mentioned, I would go through my job sites in Chicago in the bottom of a high rise, and the big banana spider, I believe it is, they would die in the basement, and their knuckles would fill with that fungi on their knuckles, and you'd have to sweep a stick to get through all of them. I just want to throw that gory outlook at you. But also, if you could describe to people, because I'm a survivalist in the wilderness, and if you get a really bad injury, spider webbing has, I think it's somewhere around 70 or 80% penicillin in the web itself, and you can pack that right into a wound. And finally, real quick, as far as ticks, you know, I came up with a method years back, and we've been using it now. People use it where you take duct tape or Gorilla tape, and you wrap it around your ankles and your waist, and it actually captures the ticks when you go out in the wilderness. So I just want to throw that at you. But Do you know what percentage of penicillin is in? I forget what percentage of penicillin is in the spider.
I'm a little confused in that pure spider webs, the proteins involved with it. I wouldn't see the penicillin, but can spider webs get moldy? You know, that's what penicillin is basically a mold. I would think so. So I'm not sure. I think I'd have to do more digging to see, but that's what it would be, is that it's not natural and pure out of the spider webbing, but can spider webs over time accumulate and become moldy with something like penicillin? That I could see as a possibility.
Hmm, interesting. I know I've heard that also, not tried it out. But, yeah, that would be something to look into. So thank you, Chris. We appreciate that. We've got some emails we want to get to. Bonnie emailed this morning. She saw a woolly caterpillar on the sidewalk, and she thought it was strange. What is their behavior at this time of year?
So woolly bear caterpillars spend the winter as a caterpillar. And if they don't get cold shock by the winter, they won't develop. So people who bring them in the house and think that they're going to get a moth coming out are usually disappointed. We're at that point now that if the little place where the critter was hiding out got warm enough, they wake up. Now, it never makes any sense to me that if you find a good place to spend the winter and you're protected, why the devil do you wake up and go somewhere else? But you see this in the fall, too, when they're crawling around. But very shortly, when things do start to warm up, that's when they pupate and go through the transformation stage, and then we'll see the adults in May and June as a kind of a yellowish-gray, rather boring little moth. I mean, the adults are not very stunning versus the caterpillar. So, yeah, by nature, many of those tiger moths, which this is a group it belongs to, spend the winter as fully mature caterpillars, go through the cold shock. They're all primed then, and then they develop into the moth the following spring.
So if we find one, should we put it somewhere where it won't get stepped on?
Yeah, you know, and put it someplace where there's something to crawl under, because the frustration's got to be for them now is that, you know, one day it's nice and you can move around, and the next day it's too cold. You know, in 30 degrees and in no sun, insects are pretty much not capable of moving. I mean, it just, their bodies just shut down.
Sure. And at the top of the hour, we had talked about spring ants. So let's talk about those a bit here. What should people know about them?
Okay, so it's definitely a point that ants naturally outdoors are not going to be active. It's still too cold. The ground's still cold. So what you tend to see, if you've got carpenter ants, which are the big black ones, when your walls warm up, and if they've been nesting in your walls or attic, this is the time of the year they become active. In fact, I'd often ask people, when did you see the first ant? If it was January, the ant nest has got to be more in the interior house that is always warm. If it's about this time of the year, it's usually outside, windowsills, that kind of thing. But the regular carpenter ants out in the trees aren't going to be active for at least 4 or 5 weeks, if not more. The other spring ant, if we call it that, there's something that I know as citronella ant. Yellow ants is another name given to them. In fact, larger yellow ant is the most common species of the group. The reason they get the name citronella is if you were to step on one, you get this very pleasant lemony or citronella-like odor. And so people used to laugh at me when I was running the lab that I'd say, have you smelt the ants? Would they have any odor about them? And this is what I was fishing for. Now, this is an ant that has no interest in people food, but they like to nest in the ground. And if they nest underneath your concrete slab, again, things are warming up enough, they think it's spring. We're, you know, it's too early. So you'll see them swarming out of cracks in the basement and the like. And so you get this just blossoming of winged ants or crawling ants, and it kind of freaks people out. It's usually a very short-lived phenomenon, a couple days at best. And as I said, it's not an ant that does anything, doesn't bite, and so it's not a problem other than the nuisance. And then, as I said, when you understand what's going on, sometimes it's as simple as caulking or sealing that seam that you see that they're coming out from, and you're done with them and you keep them outside and things are fine. So, you know, don't overreact to ants, but it is unusual. You should not be seeing ants crawling around your house now unless they are nesting in the house somewhere.
And I know people don't like them in their house, and they don't like them in their yard, but should we really be thinking about this before we destroy their nests? I mean, they're part of the ecosystem, right?
So many of the ants that you see out in your yard or in your garden are absolutely not a problem for you. I mean, as I said, we don't really have much in the way of biting ants in this state, or leaf-cutting ants like they have down south that can cause plant damage. We don't have that kind of stuff. So they are just a natural part. In fact, the cornfield ant is the one that makes those little tiny nests in your yard, and the densities are really mind-boggling when you start looking at them. It's not unusual to see, 10, 15, 20 per square yard and the like. And so there's a lot more going on out there, but most of the time it's at night. Most of the time it's underground, so people don't see that. There are some cases where ants have a relationship with aphids that there is they can enhance aphids to a little degree in population, but not enough that I worry about them. So as I said, I think people worry too much about what's going on. The very real big mound ants I can understand because you can't get your lawnmower over and whatnot, and those little critters will bite at you if you mess with them. The thing about if you ever do have to take care of an ant nest, remember in most cases the queen is down in the ground quite deep, and if you do anything on the surface, it's not going to solve the problem. You really have to either dig into or probe into and do the treatment down deep enough to kill the queen, because she's the reproductive member. She's the one that's giving you all the baby ants, per se, or, technically baby ants are grubs, but, she's the mother of the whole colony. And you can kill all the ants you want. If you don't take the queen out, the colony will still exist. And we do have ants in Wisconsin that can have colonies that last for 10 years or longer.
Wow. So how do you know how deep to go down? Is there a rule of thumb?
It's kind of a relationship on how big the nest is. Little nests, they're not very deep. When you get one of these big mound ants like we have, the field ants, honestly, I take something like a broom handle or whatnot, and because the ground is tilled where the ants are active, I'll push it down a foot, even more if I can get it farther, and then I put my treatment down those tubes so that it soaks down in the ground. And then the nice thing about that kind of treatment is then you can just take the untreated soil on top and pull it over so that you don't have the pesticide exposed to the surface.
Oh, perfect.
And yet you're taking care of things. So.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Phil. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. We'll be back to take more of your questions right after this break for the news. This is the Ideas Network, and I'm Jill Nadeau, in for Larry Mueller. We are talking about insects with Phil Pelletieri. Phil is the former head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab and is an entomologist and distinguished faculty associate emeritus. Do you have a question or comment about insects? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We've got a couple of callers who've got questions about Japanese beetles, so let's finish this topic. Lisa in French Island, what's your comment?
Hello, my pleasure. I have a friend who lives in rural Lafarge, and he has a Japanese beetle problem, and he accidentally left on a fluorescent light in his walkout basement area. And instead of the bugs all coming to his house, they went to the basement and he could easily sweep them up.
Okay.
And also, he ended up getting a bug zapper and putting it where it's warmest, and it kind of keeps them all together, and then you just sweep them or vacuum them up.
Okay. Well, thank you,
so
Lisa.
My take on that is we're talking about two different critters. What is officially the Japanese beetle is a summer problem that eats your plants. It looks kind of like a small June beetle. It's got some metallic green parts to its body and the like. The other critter that sometimes causes a Japanese beetle is the multicolored Asian lady beetle, which is one of these fall invaders. And this sounds like one of those fall invader problems that as they're waking up, they're attracted to the light. And that's what happens when they come in your house, and through a light fixture, they're going on the windows and the like. And so the bug zapper is basically cleaning up the Asian lady beetles that have invaded the house in the fall. And so, again, it still works as a nice possible solution, although bug zappers, other than taking advantage indoors where there are things that are attracted to light, and that's, they even have these in restaurants and whatnot to reduce fly numbers. One of the changes, when the zappers first came out, they literally would pulverize the insects, but that's not what you want because, again, if it's a fly and you're concerned about contaminating things, you're so many of the zappers now use far less electricity, and they just paralyze the insect, and then the insect falls down onto a sticky card or something so they can be collected. So they work a lot better there. Now, when you take them outdoors, it gets real crazy because it turns out about 90%+ of what you catch are either neutral or beneficial insects, because there's a lot of insects that are attracted to light. At one time, they were sold for mosquito control. They don't work that way. There are variations of those that we use to monitor mosquito numbers, but it's not the big zappers like you have. They're different types of light attracting, and they use different wavelengths of light because that affects insects are attracted to different things. So we don't see as many zappers as we used to. And part of it, again, I think is the word has kind of gotten out is, although, you know, people who don't like insects like to hear the sound of things frying like that, in the scheme of things, you're really not helping, and you may be harming some insects that you would rather have out there in nature.
Right. Thank you, Lisa. So you're thinking, let's just make sure everybody understands the Japanese beetles are the iridescent ones that you see more towards, what, summer and fall. And then the Asian lady beetles are the ones that look similar to the regular ladybugs that we're familiar with. Is that correct?
Yeah, in fact, they are just an Asian version of them. And,
okay.
And again, going back to, you know, how things change, when that first invaded the state, and now we're talking back in down in the 80s and like, the time that they start to invade your house is related to how the fall weather comes. And usually what it is our first decent freeze, the first nice day after that, that's sunny and the like, it's like you turned a light on. They were nowhere and now they're everywhere. And that seems to be the trigger for them to coming into your house. But when this got the worst, I remember it was so bad one day in my laboratory that my phone went dead because I could never put it down long enough to get it charged because of the number of calls coming in.
Wow.
I will tell you, you know, as I said, this was quite some time ago. You still have years that they're problematic, but not like it was back in that first wave. It's just interesting. That has been the trend for every invasive insect I can think of that arrived in the state during my career, that they don't go away completely, but it's those first few years that they're here that they seem to cause the most frustration and problems.
Okay, so don't panic. Okay, John, in Elgin, Illinois, you have a question about Japanese beetles.
I have a minor Japanese beetle problem last year, but in putting down bulbs in the fall, I found a lot of them. Where I was planting the bulbs. I've heard that beneficial nematodes will kill them in the soil. Is that true?
It is true, but you have to think the densities it would take. I don't expect them to be a bulb problem per se. They're basically a turf eater, so they like the roots of grass. When we start getting densities of 10 per square foot in a lawn, that's a high enough number that they'll damage the lawn, and then they have to be dealt with. And nematodes are an option, but the problem is they're expensive. You know, the nematodes go in, and so in most cases in lawn situations, it's just not economically feasible. If you had a situation where you thought they were causing damage in something of higher value, like bulbs, the nematodes would be an option. But as I said, I don't worry about them at all in my garden. I you know, dig them up when you're planting things, but it's a couple here, a couple there type of thing, and I just don't see them feeding into the roots of other plants, as I said, because they have this affinity for turf and in grass in particular, grass roots.
Okay, thank you, John. We did, speaking of ladybugs, a listener called but couldn't stay with us, wanting to know, are there baby ladybugs?
Okay, so really, ladybugs are beetles.
Okay.
And beetles have a life cycle that their immature stage is a larvae. It's a worm-like creature. The best way to describe them is they look like little alligators to me.
Oh.
You know, they are kind of elongated. They're kind of warty-bodied. And they're predators on aphids and other things. And so they're very beneficial to have out there. Most people don't see them because you kind of have to go looking for them. But I will tell you, very often if you have an aphid infestation on a plant and you give it a couple weeks, you will all of a sudden start to see both the adults and the larval stage of the lady beetles show up, both of them feeding on the aphids. And so, and that's the same. You know, I was teasing earlier in the show about ants. Well, there's no such thing as a baby ant. The ant that you see is an adult. The immature stage of an ant is a maggot-like creature that we call a larvae that lives down in the nest and has to be cared for by the adult ants. They're really pretty helpful little creatures. And so, you know, there's a number of insects that have this transformation stage. We're all familiar with the moths and butterflies, but all the ants, the wasps, as I said, a number of creatures have this more complicated life cycle.
Okay, thank you very much. Owen in Cornucopia emailed us, and he was wondering about tent caterpillars. In 2000, northern Wisconsin, basically Bayfield County, experienced huge numbers of caterpillars hanging on trees, defoliating the birch, poplar, aspen, and other trees. And Owen was told that they undergo periodic outbreaks, but it hasn't happened since. Is this tent caterpillar outbreak periodic, or is it more dependent on certain conditions?
Yeah, it's more conditional to a degree. So the one that bothers him is called the forest tent caterpillar, and the craziness is it does not make a tent. The one that we all think about in the spring is the eastern tent caterpillar, which is more of a fruit tree problem, feeds on cherries and the like. And so, but when forest tent caterpillar gets outbreaks, you have this total defoliation of plants. In fact, I remember sometimes some of the big marathon races up there, they had to sweep the roads because they were so slippery with all the worms.
Yes.
Some people incorrectly call them army worms. That's a different kind of critter. But and you can somewhat predict, you know, the DNR forestry people go out and sample, and they're looking for the egg masses because that's how the critter overwinters. You don't find any egg masses, it's not going to be a problem. But if you start to see the number of egg masses building on poplar and some of the other plants they like, you can predict when the outbreak will be. Outbreak lasts for a couple, 3 years, and then there is a native fly that is a parasite of tent caterpillars that knocks its population down. One of the common names for it is a friendly fly, because these flies land on people and just hang out, and they're really quite bothersome. So when the friendly flies show up, the tent caterpillar populations will crash. The next year you see a few friendly flies, and then they disappear. And so there's this interesting dance between the two. And as I said, it is predictable. I have not been keeping up as much as I did when I was running the lab. But the DNR usually has a tent caterpillar forecast, as I said, because they can go out, the foresters, and sample to see what's happening. So you can usually see it coming a year or two in advance. So.
Okay. Great question, Owen. Thank you. And speaking of things that hang on trees, what's the latest on the spongy moth? Don't they start hatching soon?
Yeah, so, you know, the critter that we used to call the gypsy moth, you know, we have changed the name, they overwinter as egg masses that are kind of plastered. And the name spongy moth refers to it. It kind of looks a little bit like a flattened sponge. And inside that are, you know, anywhere from 50 to as many as 400 or 500 eggs. And they hatch just about the time the buds are breaking on the trees, oak trees and some of the other things that they feed on. And so one of the things that you can do is, because these egg masses are off on the trunk and whatnot, you can peel them off, you can spray them with soybean oils. And the old argument is that you take an egg mass out, you're taking out hundreds of caterpillars at a time, versus if you let them hatch and they start crawling around, they're much more difficult to deal with. So if you had significant issues with spongy moth last year, then it's well worth looking around in your shrubbery and seeing where things are going. It can be very bad in one area and go down the road 10 miles and you don't see it at all. I mean, it's really kind of hard to predict sometimes, but much like the tent caterpillar, in general, if you're monitoring them statewide, you kind of get the feel. The one dynamic that seems to influence their populations is spring weather. If things are wet, there's honestly viruses and fungal diseases that kill a lot of the small caterpillars, so their populations don't do well. If we have dry springs a couple years in a row, those are the conditions that tend to get us in trouble with those populations as things go on. So, you know, for a lot of reasons, we pray for spring rain, but one of my purposes is to take care of those little critters.
Sure. Well, how do you dispose of them safely?
Well, really, you don't have to do much. As I said, you can spray them, and there are soybean oil sprays for them with it. They just suffocate. You don't have to crawl them off, take care of them there. If I were to scrape them off, I would throw them in the trash or something like that. I mean, there's just no way that those critters are going to recover,
okay,
to infest something. you know, if they were on a branch and you cut the branch and just threw it on the ground, well, then, of course, they're going to survive. But if you physically destroy them in one manner, they're just not going to be able to recover from that.
And how big are these masses? Is it something you can see readily?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Okay. Probably a size of a silver dollar, if not more.
Okay.
And as I said, they're kind of whitish. And if you look at them closely, you often see little hairs intertwined with them. Those are hairs from the female when she's, you know, spinning things off and the like, and if you look on the internet, you'll see lots of pictures of them. And again, if you're walking in the woods, it catches your attention because there's all these white masses plastered in, and when they get dense, I mean, you can find, you know, 8-9 per square foot. It's just crazy. But then if you multiply that times 400, you can see why they're so problematic in numbers.
Sure. Great. Okay. Well, look out for those. This is a perfect time right now. And let's go back to the phone. Margo in Prairie du Chien. Hi, Margo.
Hi. I'm having, this is the second year, a problem with tiny little black ants. And I spoke to a friend of mine, and he's had the same problem. I don't know where they're coming from. I've tried to figure out whether they're, you know, like attracted to grease or sugar. They like to stay around the sink areas and the stove.
Sure. Was there a pattern, or did they like both grease and sugar?
I've seen them on both.
Okay.
In fact, I have cats, and I put a bowl of milk down that had a little sugar in the cereal.
Mm-hmm.
And I left the milk there for my cats, and I got up in the morning, and it was just lousy with these little black, tiny little black ants.
Okay, thank you, Margo. Okay. What do you think, Phil?
Well, being tiny, they're probably not carpenter ants, because carpenter ants are medium to large in size. You know, if we knew what species of ant it is, we can point a finger much quicker. But that's somewhat immaterial in the sense that I don't think she's going to be able to find the nest. But because they're active right now, again, they're someplace warm. The ground outside is definitely not warm enough, so we know they're nesting in the house. What's important here, these ants should be able to be baited quite easily. And that's why it was worth trying to find out if they had a preference, because there are some baits that are just sweet baits, some that have more of a protein type of thing, which would be the grease. And they do sell various ant traps, even in pet-proof containers, so that we don't have to worry about the cats, because that's always something you're concerned about. And you give the ants what they like, and many times they're just using something as innocent as boric acid as the thing that's killing the ants. But they pick it up and they go back to the colony, and not just feeding their other worker ants, they feed the queen. And that's why baiting ants, if you can get bait acceptance, is the perfect way to do it. There are baits that you can buy at the hardware store. A lot of times those are pretty reasonable. There are a couple ants, though, that we run into that get a little bit more specialized, and you have to buy more commercial baits that you have to mail order. But I would just try again to identify if they did have a bit of a preference. It does seem they like protein. That doesn't, you know, the milk type of stuff. And use the traps, put them in a place that the ants, close to where the ants are active, but away from the pets, although I'm not as nervous in some of these ant traps, as I said, because they are basically tamper-proof. The one thing you got to keep doing is keep baiting them as long as there's any activity, and even for a week after that, because they have to pick up enough bait to take care of the whole colony. And so it might take a couple, 3 weeks of going after them, and make sure that if they eat all the bait, you give them more bait. But I think that would be the highest chance of success in the most reasonable way of going after them.
Okay, thank you, Margo. And we had Bill in Oregon send us an email, and he's wondering which insects are the most and the least susceptible to erratic spring temperatures.
Okay, so it depends on what the life stage and what you've made them do. So let's take tent caterpillar for an example. They're really quite hardy critters. Their eggs are going to hatch about the time the apple trees start to really blossom, and flower in the buds are breaking. That's where the caterpillars, if they hatch, and we got little tiny caterpillars, and then we get, you know, one of these crazy, you know, 4-inch snowfalls or the like, that's going to shut them down. more than anything. But if they were still in the egg stage, it doesn't affect them one way or another. So the difference of a week in the development of the insect would make them susceptible or not. And so, as I said, that's what I tend to try to look for, and that's why it's so hard to predict where some of these things are going to go, because I'm not quite sure where the weather is going to be 3 or 4 weeks from now. But definitely there's this correlation that if we get well into April and then we have a dramatic, you know, the kind of weather that's causing plant damage, you know, for, again, mm-hmm. you know, young buds and the whatnot, is generally the kind of stuff that will get insects in trouble. The other thing is very heavy rains. Same kind of story. If they're small and susceptible, and then you get these monsoons coming in, that often will really knock their populations down. But you've got other insects that aren't, you know, we've got critters that fly up here from down south every year. You know, this kind of weather doesn't affect them. So that's why it's hard to predict generally across the board what will happen to insects, because there's so many different scenarios that will affect different populations.
Sure. So the answer is it depends.
Yeah.
So I think you got this picture from Jim in Milwaukee. He found this little clay ball, which is like an inch and a quarter long, on the forest floor in Milwaukee County. And he remembers that the area where he found it, but he put it in his shirt jacket and later saw that it was infested with ants. He was wondering if the ants made this or were they just occupying it?
Yeah, I think they were just occupying it. It would be very interesting if he's willing to cut this open. When I look at the picture very carefully, I wonder if this is more some kind of crazy dried fruit or some other substance similar. It just doesn't look soil-like. There's almost like little veins and markings on it, which, as I said, which led me towards the plant side of things. But even if it was clay, I mean... ants will dig holes in things, but they don't construct the kind of ants we have here, any kind of thing. So I think they were making use of whatever little void space there was in this object. But I'm real fascinated what the object really is. I don't know if maybe even just putting it in a little bit of water to see if that softens it up and clarifies a little bit more what the substance is that creates it. But as I said, I'm leaning just from the pictures that he put that it might be something kind of a dried plant-based something more so than it is clay.
Yeah, I agree with you. It definitely looks like more of a nut or pod of some sort. So, Okay, we got one more caller, and Pat in Three Lakes, we've only got a little time, so ask your question quickly, please.
Yeah, I have a question about, I see all these organizations, companies called, you know, mosquito police and mosquito cops, a lot of my neighbors are using these individuals, and they're probably all right, but I noticed over the last two summers that my songbirds haven't been coming around as much, and this last summer especially.
Okay, thank you, Pat.
Yeah, they do affect general insect populations. That's been shown, because you're putting a pesticide that's killing critters daily for a couple weeks, if not more, and then you apply it more than once. My take on this is, if you said, my daughter's having a wedding in my backyard, and we're going to have a bunch of guests, should I have my backyard sprayed during a bad mosquito season? Yes, but once. Where you get into trouble, if you repeatedly do it, you are upsetting the ecology, and then all kinds of things start to unravel. So, as I said, these companies probably don't like to hear me say that, but that's my take on it, that there are certain circumstances. I understand that it is useful, but it's a temporary one-shot type of deal, and if you keep going that way. The other thing you find is, since most of our mosquitoes are migrating in, you're really not affecting the breeding populations. I mean, if you're serious about mosquitoes, that's what you have to do. Unfortunately, that takes kind of a countywide basis. You can't do that as an individual.
It's a good thing to take care of. Make sure you look for those pools of water and empty tires or whatever, right?
Right. There are situations you can breed them on your property, but most of our mosquitoes are floodwater mosquitoes, and they're coming from 10 miles down the road. And you know, in wet years, they're a problem. In dry years, they're not. And that's the other argument, is that you sign up for a service this year. I don't know. If it's a dry year, I don't need a service.
Sure.
If it's a wet year, it's going to be bad enough in certain circumstances. I don't care how much you spray, you still got mosquitoes.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you so much, Phil. You've answered so many questions for people. We really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll hear from you in a couple of months.
Sounds good.
Okay, bye-bye. We've been talking with Phil Pelletieri. He's an entomologist and a Distinguished Faculty Associate Emeritus at UW-Madison. Join us again tomorrow when we'll help you out with your tax questions. Mary Mellon will be back with us. Hope you can join us then. I'm Jill Nadeau, in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network, and stay well.